This episode is sponsored by Transcend, a veteran-owned and operated performance optimization company that I introduced recently as a sponsor on this show. Well, since then, I have actually been using my products and I've had incredible success. There was initial blood work that was extremely detailed, and based on that, they offered supplementation. So I began taking DHEA, BPC-157 for inflammation, based on the fact that I've been a stuntman, a martial artist, and a firefighter my whole life, lots of aches and pains, Dihexa to help cognition after multiple punches to the head and shift work, and peptides. 4 months later, they did a detailed blood work again, and I was actually able to taper off two of the peptides because my body had responded so well to just one of them that it was optimized at that point. So I cannot speak highly enough of the immense range of supplementation that they offer, whether it's male health, female health, peptides to boost your own testosterone, which I would argue is needed by a lot of the fire service, or whether it's exogenous testosterone needed, especially after TBIs or advanced age. Now, as I mentioned before, the other side of this company is an altruistic arm called the Transcend Foundation, which is putting veterans and first responders through some of their protocols free of charge. Now, Transcend are also offering you, the audience, 10% off their protocols, and you can find that on jamesgearing.com under the products tab. And if you want to hear more about Transcend and their story, listen to episode 808 with the founder, Ernie Colling, or go to transcendcompany.com. This episode is sponsored by a company I've literally been using for over 15 years now, and that is 5.11. Now, my introduction to their products began when I started wearing 5.11 uniforms years ago for Anaheim Fire Department. And since then, I have acquired a host of their backpacks and luggage, which have literally been around the world with me. The backpack where I keep all my recording equipment is a 5.11 backpack. And then most of my civilian gear, the clothes that I wear, are also 5.11. Now, more recently, they've actually branched out into the brick and mortar stores. So, for example, Gainesville, where I do jiu-jitsu, has a beautiful 5.11 store. So if you are a fire department, a law enforcement agency, you now have access to an entire inventory of clothing and equipment in these 5.11 stores. Now, I've talked about the range of shoes they have and how important minimizing weight in our footwear is when it comes to our back health, knee health, etc. I've talked about their unique uniforms that are fitted for either male or female first responders. And then I want to highlight one new area, their CloudStrike packs. For those of you who enjoy hiking, this would even be an application, I believe, for the wildland community. They've created an ultralight pack now with a hydration system built in for rucking, running, or other long-distance events. Now, as always, 5.11 is offering you, the audience of the Behind the Shield podcast, 15% off every purchase that you make. So if you use the code SHIELD15, that's SHIELD15, at 511tactical.com, you will get that 15% off every single time. So if you want to hear more about 5.11 and their origin story, go to episode 338 of Behind the Shield podcast with their CEO, Francisco Morales. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome back onto the show author and filmmaker Sebastian Junger. Now, as you would have heard in previous episodes, Sebastian's work has impacted so many of us in uniform. Whether it was his book Tribe or the documentary Restrepo, he has a unique lens that seems to see the very things that we in uniform observe on a daily basis. Now, in his most recent book, In My Time of Dying, Sebastian details his own near-death experience where he almost bled out from a ruptured pancreatic artery, but also the philosophical and spiritual journey he took after that event. So we discuss a host of topics, from the medical side of his near death through to the exploration of mortality and spirituality and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 900 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I welcome back Sebastian Junger. Enjoy. Well, Sebastian, I want to say welcome back again. I think we spoke only about 6 months ago and you couldn't talk about the new book because obviously it wasn't quite ready to be put out to the world yet. But now we actually get to unpack what you've been working on for a long time. So I want to welcome you back onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Hey, thank you very much. Just as a note, I'm a little funny looking this morning because I came down with shingles. And if you have chicken pox, it comes back later in life as shingles if you don't get your shots, which you must, because it is awful. And it's all over the top of my head, my forehead, and in my right eye. So if I look like I got beat up, I wasn't. I was beat up by shingles. So
I was wondering.
Anyway, So that's definitely get your shots. So anyway, thank you for having me on your podcast.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know we've talked before, and I know you haven't more recently, but up until not too long ago, you were boxing a lot. So I just figured that you got back in the ring and with the wrong person.
Right. Failed to slip the punch. Right. Yeah. No. If only. It's one of the few diseases you can give to yourself. And, you don't get it from someone else. You give it to yourself. The five-year-old version of me gave this to me, right? It's at age 62. It's pretty crazy.
It is. Well, speaking of that, it's a good segue. So, you and I have spoken a lot. We've kind of dived into so much of your work. Tribe, I say this every time we talk, to this day is still held as one of the most important books, certainly in the uniform profession. So I'm really, really excited to unpack this new one. I think the best way to start will be to go back to parents and grandparents and kind of talk about the two different kind of philosophies that they were raised with, and then we'll come back forward to, to your near-death experience and beyond. So talk to me about, if you want to go your father or even further back, each side of your family and the kind of philosophies and principles that they were raised on.
Yeah, so my mother is a straight-up American gal from the Midwest. Her ancestors settled the Pennsylvania frontier. Some of them were killed by Indians, by Delaware Indians in an attack in the 1780s. They homesteaded, and she came to Boston and met my dad as an art student, and eventually as a follower of some of the more sort of mystical ideas of macrobiotics and yoga and sort of Eastern mysticism. And she sort of believed in what she called energy, right? Like if you're sick, it's because you have bad energy, or if like your marriage is going south, it's bad energy, or you whatever, everything's sort of energy. So my father was totally the opposite. He was a physicist and he was raised in Europe. He speaks just about every language in Europe because born in 1923, fascism kept chasing him around the countries of Europe. He was born in Dresden. His father was Jewish. They left in 33. After the Reichstag fire, they went to Spain, left in 36 when the fascists came in under Franco, went to Paris, and left when the Nazis came into France. So he speaks all these languages thanks to the fascists. Anyway, he wound up in America and met my mother. And, he was the sort of ultimate rationalist and scientist. And, he would say to my mother, look, energy is subatomic work potential. Right. Like it's not some sort of vague thing that makes marriages go bad and gives you cancer. And my mother invariably would say, oh, Miguel, you're so narrow minded, which means you're so literal. Right. But there, there in front of me played out the great sort of schism and debate in probably every society, but certainly post-Enlightenment Western society, which is faith versus reason. empiricism versus belief. And you know, of course, airplanes don't drop out of the sky, and medicine works, and we know how to do complicated surgical procedures, and we can forecast the weather and solar eclipses, and et cetera. I mean, the list is endless because of empiricism and rationality. And there's this other, but there's this other way of looking at life and looking at the world, which leaves open some sort of foggier questions of how does this all work and what's it mean? And I think many people, as I did, and I know we'll get to this later, when they encounter the sort of raw facts of mortality and death, there are some reasons to sort of wonder, do we really understand everything in physical terms? Like, are we missing something very, very important that we just don't quite understand?
You have a one parent who's brought up in a very kind of holistic, you know, people would probably label it like hippie-esque, you know, way of thinking. Then you have the very mathematical side on your dad's side. What was the conversation about spirituality or religion or faith when you were in the formative years?
Oh, there was none. We were all atheists. My mother fled Catholicism when she fled Ohio, and my father was a secular half-Jew physicist in America I finally went to church when I was 18 for an anthropology assignment, so we were just never raised with that kind of thinking. And for example, my father, one day I remember my mother telling me this story when she was newly married. I mean, just to give you an idea of who my father was, so he was definitely on this, he was way on the spectrum. And a very, very sweet man, right? But out to lunch, right? And so one evening, my father was like sitting in the armchair in front of the fire, is how I imagine it, you know. And my mom was, you know, preparing dinner. They'd just gotten married and still getting to know each other. And my father was in the armchair reading a book. And he was muttering to himself, oh my God, that's gorgeous. That's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. It's exquisite. And my mother, you know, could hear him and was like, wow, what is it that's completely captivated my new husband? What great beauty. I mean, what's going on, right? She tiptoed over and the book was open on his lap and the page was entirely filled with equations, mathematical equations. So my mother said, oh, okay, really nothing to worry about here, right? So that was my dad. And you know, ultimately, my main concern is human dignity and human suffering. May there be as little of it as possible. And to the extent that religion helps people lead dignified, meaningful lives and alleviate suffering, I'm all for it. You know, what I'm against, and what my father was against, was the misapplication, the misuse of religion, when religion actually doesn't follow its own high precepts. And you know, for example, my father spent a lot of his early years in Spain, and he has good friends there. And there was a family friend who was dying of cancer, very, very painful cancer. This is in the 1980s. Now the fascists are out, and with the fascists went this sort of like, it was no longer a quote Catholic country, officially a Catholic country, because the fascists and the Catholics were very, very closely wedded politically. So it was essentially a secular country, but. So this dear friend was dying of cancer and in enormous pain, agonizing, excruciating pain in the hospital in his final hours. And the son called my father in a rage, saying that the doctor refused to give him morphine, refused to give the dying father morphine. He said, it's God's will that he suffer. And the more he suffers now, the less time he'll spend in purgatory. That's the problem my father had with religion. And for all the beautiful ideas that come out of religion, what I find is that the religious community really refuses to engage with that kind of wrongdoing, that kind of frankly, evil history that lies in its past and even its somewhat recent past.
I've said this on the podcast a lot recently. You know, I think there's so much good in the common denominators of all the religions together. If you make a massive Venn diagram, in the middle is kindness, compassion, gratitude, community. But the moment you're like, but if you don't believe in mine, and here's what's going to happen, A, B, C, D, and E. And it's crazy because a lot of these people within some of these organizations are so far from what I believe these, you know, these good people, these prophets, whatever you want to label them as, would do in the same situation. And the perfect example, you look at homelessness and addiction, and people, you know, that I know spend Sundays in a certain place, and they just want them moved out of their city or stop giving them Narcan, you know. So there is a huge detachment between what I would consider my version of spirituality, which is just being a good person. I think my holy book could just say, don't be a dick, and that would be it. That would cover everything. And, you know, and then the teachings of these people and what they're actually doing when they leave the building.
Yeah. And, you know, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the crucial idea here is that, yes, religion helps promote good behavior, but that kind of basic human morality and compassion obviously predates religion or predates Christianity, right? It didn't suddenly arise in the year zero when Christ was born, right? And, you know, for example, and I'm stealing shamelessly from the late great Christopher Hitchens, the story that Christ tells of the Good Samaritan, who rends his cloak in two to give half his cloak to a passerby on the highway as they're walking along who's cold. He tears his cloak in two and gives him half of his cloak to this stranger who's suffering. That obviously happened before Christianity, because Christianity started with Christ. And so that story is an early pre-Christian story of generosity and compassion. So in other words, clearly those wonderful human values of compassion and helping a suffering person, even if they're a stranger, you don't need to be Christian to act that way and to believe in those things. And frankly, I do. And I'm a straight up, like, boiled in the wool, whatever the expression is, atheist, right? Like a stone cold atheist. And I've those ideals, those Christian ideals are foremost in my mind. I just don't ascribe them to God. And I don't think I'm going to hell if I don't act well.
I've made this observation a few times. Again, this is just my hypothesis, but when we look at evolution, we're like, oh, look, we built the wheel and we built spears and now we built, you know, the computer and AI. But to me, those are superfluous. I mean, obviously they helped advance, you know, human society in some respects. But to me, what I see as evolution is the increase in kindness and compassion. You look at some of the horrendous things that humans did a long time ago. I think that is the evolution. Now, there's a lot of people still trying to drag us back into the dark ages under the guise of a religion or, you know, race or whatever the thing is that they stand on their podium about. But to me, that's I think, is the advancement of the human being that separates us maybe from some of our animal, you know, brethren, is the increase in compassion and empathy.
Yeah, I mean, I've written about this in previous books. There are these two sort of categories, like how do you treat people within your own community and how do you treat outsiders, the enemy? And of course, the enemy is dangerous. I mean, outsiders can be dangerous. I mean, look what's happening in Ukraine with Russia right now, right? So compassion for the outsiders, if they're coming to cut your throat, isn't such a great idea. On the other hand, so you have to be able to defend yourself. On the other hand, how you treat people in your own community, and I'm speaking in evolutionary terms for hundreds of thousands of years, if you were not prepared to be on guard against people you didn't know, you were vulnerable to them, and you and all your family and loved ones might be killed or enslaved, right? So that's just a historical reality that the right-minded moral person has to bear in mind if they want to stay alive. On the other hand, people within your own community, when you treat them unjustly, you are undoing the very bonds that keeps the community safe and cohesive and able to repel an outside attack. And it's deeply immoral. And one of the problems with the wonderful advent of agriculture and then industry and technology is that it allows for the accumulation of wealth and therefore an accumulation of power in certain individuals, which is ripe for abuse. And the sort of early small-scale organic hunter-gatherer communities that typify our human ancestors I mean, not without exception, but as far as we understand from the anthropology and the archaeology, the vast majority were tremendously egalitarian for the simple reason is that if you're that mobile, you can't carry around all your wealth. There really is no wealth to accumulate. And leadership isn't a function of power. It's a function of persuasion and given authority. So the leader is given authority by the people. And if he abuses it, it's taken away. And that person is often killed. And that all changed with the advent of agriculture and the city state and eventually industry and technology. And now we have highly stratified societies with very, very wealthy people on top who control the majority of the collective assets of the society. And frankly, except in the most pure democracies, frankly, can sort of sidestep the weight of the law. They can manipulate the legal system, the tax system, the political system to their own advantages in ways that people living in a cardboard box on Broadway in Manhattan, you know, just are not able to do. And, you know, frankly, that's just reality. It's not fair, but it's reality.
Absolutely. Well, I want to get back to the path of the new book, because I know that we talked a lot about that in the previous conversation, and it was amazing. When I was 18, one of my classmates from my senior school, so from 11 to 16, we were in school together, died in a single car accident. He drove into the side of a house. And that was the first real experience of death. I mean, I was so fortunate. I lost my grandparents literally a few years ago at 99 and 100 and basically 105 years old. So yeah, I've been spared from a lot of funerals, apart from all the firefighters that I've gone to bury, which is why I do this podcast. But it absolutely shook me when my friend died, because, you know, that was the realization that you're not immortal, that you're not going to live forever. And then it was about a year later that one of my friends that I went on a ski trip with, real deep thinker, was talking about A Brief History of Time and about the infinite universe and multiple, you know, what they call them now, the quantum realms. Basically, I blew my mind back then, but now Spider-Man's explained it better for me. but you know, it was such a jarring moment of my life, you know, from 18 to 19, where that mortality really grabbed me by the throat. And, it scared me for a long, long time. I know we're going to talk about your actual near-death experience, but when you look back, because you touch on several, you know, kind of either moments that were very scary for you or actual near-death experiences prior to that event. Obviously, you and I have talked about losing Tim Hetherington, talked about Restrepo. So when the other side of this, writing the book and analyzing some of these moments, maybe a little deeper, what were other pivotal moments prior to that where your perception of your own mortality maybe shifted slightly?
Yeah, so it's more complicated than you would think. I mean, I've seen plenty of dead people in war zones, but it was like, oh, that's happened to them. That's not me, right? And partly because I had to travel to be in a place where life and death sort of like were in such close proximity. But back home, it all seemed rather safe, and that we were firmly in the realm of life, and death was sort of this distant, far-off thing that I knew abstractly was waiting for all of us, but really it was not part of my daily reality. So the reality of death was in other people's countries when they were at war. And then the people that I knew who were killed were killed in wars. So you had to sort of travel to find your mortality. You had to sort of travel. I mean, that was my experience of it. And I did plenty of things that could get me killed. And I had incidents in war zones where I came very close. I was blown up in an IED and it went off under the engine block instead of under the crew compartment. And, you know, that might've saved us. Certainly great harm, if not death. And, I had a bullet hit a few inches from my head into a sandbag, you know, shot from 500 meters. What's the angle of the rifle barrel that saved my life? So small, you hardly calculate it, et cetera, et cetera. I had plenty of that, right? But it was all like, oh, well, that happens over there. And if you don't want that to happen, don't go over there. Stay home, right? And you know, when I was young, I was as a struggling writer, I started I was working as a climber for tree companies. So that meant that if someone was taking down a big tree in their backyard or over their house, and they couldn't just cut it down. You have to take it down in pieces. And if you can't get a crane in there, you need a climber. You need someone at the top of the tree hanging on a line, 5 or 6,000 test nylon line, with a chainsaw, piecing the tree out, cutting it down in pieces, offering lowering the heavy chunks so they don't damage what's below it. It's a kind of reverse architecture that allows you to take down even a 100-foot white pine in a small space. So that was my job, and obviously inherently dangerous. And I was very, very scared of heights. I mean, we're wired to be scared of heights. Heights, you know, heights will get you killed, right? It's like like snakes, you know, we all react sort of badly to those threats. And I had a very hard time with the heights. And basically what I learned to just, I never got over my fear of heights. I just learned to not look down. And I feel like we all, you know, just focus in front of you, make sure your knots are tied, make sure you're the front cut and the back cut is, you're doing them properly, which direction is the wind coming from, et cetera, you know, like all the little details that keep you alive in a dangerous environment, focus on those. Just don't look down, right? And so I feel like we all do that. Like we're leading our lives and we're, you know, writing our thesis, and then we're raising our kids, and we're making breakfast, and we're catching the bus. We all this stuff, right? It's like, and you can do it all as long as you don't look down. Like, as long as you know, like, oh my God, I'm gonna die one day, and it might even be today. Who knows? Like, you can't do that. I mean, you know it's the truth, but if you do that, it's paralyzing, right? So, my real understanding of mortality really didn't come until it came after me, until death came, the front lines came after me in my home in what was presumably a very safe place. There's no gunfire in my, we were in Massachusetts during COVID in a house, in an old house built in 1800, deep in the woods at the end of a dead end dirt road, like the safest, most beautiful place you can imagine. And the antithesis of a war zone. And that was where I really almost died. And it came with absolutely no warning at all. It was a morning like any other. You know, I'm fit. I'm healthy. I'm an athlete. My heart's perfect. My health is perfect. I'm not going to drop dead of a heart attack. You know, I mean, I have none of those things that might make a 58-year-old man worried about their longevity. I had none of those things, right? And yet, I almost died. I should have died. My odds of dying were incredibly high, and I somehow made it. And it came absolutely out of nowhere. And my reality changed literally in one moment. I went from just an ordinary person like you are right now having a conversation to, boom, dying. You have 90 minutes. Go. Brutal.
So walk me through that then. We're talking about June 16th, 2020. So obviously we're in, you know, the beginning of the pandemic as well. You're in a somewhat rural area. Walk me through from, you know, you realizing there's something wrong, telling your wife, and then, you know, the ambulance and beyond.
Yeah. So I own this old house deep in the woods, and I built a little cabin even deeper into the woods from the house, like with the wood, you know, with wood stove and no electricity, no running water. It's a really rustic place. And so it's a nice, so we had a rare bit of childcare, babysitting from a family that we know up the road. They had two teenage girls. And so that once in a while they come over and just take care of our little girls. At the time they were 6 months old and 3 years old. Take care of our little girls for a few hours so we could get some work done or whatever. So, I said to my wife, Barbara, like, listen, it's a beautiful afternoon. Let's just go chill out in the cabin. Like, and I literally said, no one knows how many more of these they're going to get. It's beautiful. Let's just, instead of like getting stuff done, let's just throttle back for an hour, right? So we walked out of this cabin and there's no cell phone service and the transport time for emergency services from where we are is over an hour. It's one of the longest transport times in the state of Massachusetts. But of course, I don't care because I'm in great health. I'm never going to have to rush to the hospital. You know, I'm fine. Like, but I'll drive myself there. You know, I mean, that is like that kind of stupid attitude, right? So in mid-sentence, while we're in the cabin, we're chatting, right? And it's a beautiful, soft summer afternoon, and we're chatting, and I suddenly felt this sort of pain in my abdomen. And it's like, it's worse, it's a lot worse than indigestion, but it's not kidney stone pain. It's somewhere in the middle, right? It's not agony. It's just like, ooh, what is that? And no matter what I did, you know, I couldn't make it go away. Usually if you have some kind of digestive pain, you can, you know, work it out. Nothing affected it. So I stood up to see if I could sort of walk it out, and I almost fell over. And I said to my wife, I sat back down. I said to my wife, I'm going to need help. I'm going to need some help. I don't know what's going on. I've never felt like this in my life. And I was getting very lightheaded. So we stood up and I put my arm around her, and she sort of half walked, half dragged me out of the cabin and down the trail back to the driveway. And it had rained recently, so the phone lines were out. There was the landlines were out because they're old landlines, and they just get like, they short out and you can't use them. And there's no cell phone connection. So we're really like, what do we do? So we went, Barbara put me in the passenger seat of the car and ran into the house and told the teenagers, something really bad going on, and take care of the girls. We have to get them to the hospital. And one of the teenagers came out and managed to get one bar of signal on her phone. If she walked around the driveway, she got one bar of signal and called 911. And, you know, meanwhile, I'm starting to go blind, and I'm in and out of consciousness. My wife is like holding my hand saying, stay with me. You got to stay with me. And she's watching me go in and out. And whenever I go out, I stay longer and longer, and then I come back, and I have no idea I'm going in and out of consciousness. But I've gone blind now. And so what I didn't know, what I found out later, was that I had an aneurysm in my pancreatic artery, which is like this little artery that no one actually really needs to talk about, have any real reason to talk about, right? There's five of them, and one of my five pancreatic arteries, I had an aneurysm, which is a ballooning of the blood vessel because of a weak spot or excess pressures. And it's a structural abnormality, right? It's not high cholesterol and, you know, whatever. It's not coronary disease. I mean, it's a structural problem. And it's related to my celiac artery is, for some reason, very few people have this, but it's compressed by a ligament that's in the wrong place. And it's called median arcuate ligament syndrome, and it forces the blood out through smaller arteries, and one of them ballooned. And this happens over the course of your lifetime, right? This is a slow process, and eventually the artery walls get sort of weaker and weaker, and eventually they rupture. Now, if someone just stabs you and you start bleeding out into your own abdomen, if someone stabs you in the stomach, in the abdomen, the doctors will know where to put their finger, right? Like where to plug the leak, right? Because you have a stab wound. With internal hemorrhage, with abdominal hemorrhage, your abdomen's basically a big bowl of spaghetti. I mean, they have no idea where it is, right? And so it's extremely dangerous. And now I'm losing, in the end, I needed 10 units of blood. I'm losing probably a pint of blood every 10 or 15 minutes. And it took me 90 minutes to get to the ER. I mean, I probably lost 2/3 of my blood by that time, conservatively, by the time I got to the ER. So by the time the medics get there, the ambulance gets there, I've gone into compensatory shock. And which means that my body is shut down, all the extraneous stuff, the legs, the arms, you know, whatever. It's pooled all the blood. This is unconsciously, right? This is not a conscious decision, but your body is containing it, all the blood in your chest and in your brain, you know, where it's needed. And I even lost control of my bowels, because even your intestines aren't even getting the blood supply they need, right? Everything's sort of just letting go, right? But because I went into compensatory shock, my brain sort of rebooted. So I'm like, now I'm clear-minded again. I'm not blind anymore. I just have belly pain. But so the medics got there, and I was like, you know, I think I'm okay. You know, I just, this is why married men live longer. It's a famous statistic, right? My wife was like, no, he was passing out a few minutes ago. You're taking him to the hospital. Like, don't listen to him. Like, take him to the hospital. And so my compensatory shock lasted for about the entire hour of the transport. And right when I got to the emergency department in Hyannis, I went off a cliff. And, you know, the guy in the back of the ambulance wasn't particularly worried either. He gave me an IV bag and he was like, oh, it's probably just indigestion. And, you know, no one was tracking this, right? And then as soon as we got to the emergency department, I turned pale, incoherent. I mean, I just all the classic signs of like imminent death from hemorrhagic shock. And so they rushed me into a trauma bay. And, you know, I'm still sort of semi-conscious. I'm puzzled by all the activity. Everyone looks so worried. Like, why are there so many people here? Why do you all look so worried? I tried joking with them. Nobody laughed. I'm like, damn, this is one serious party. Like, what's going on, guys? Like, I'm just here for belly pain. Like, and so I remember the doctor, they needed to put blood into me to transfuse me. And I said, and I remembered on my helmet when I was in combat, I'd written O positive on the side of my helmet so that if I were wounded, medics would know what kind of blood type I was. And so I said, I remember my helmet on my army helmet, I had O positive. I think I'm O positive. They're like, okay, thank you. And so he said, I need your permission to put a large gauge needle directly into your jugular. Right. And I was like, God, that doesn't sound like a huge amount of fun, doc. Like, why? What you mean? In case there's an emergency. And he said, this is the emergency right now. I said, okay. So we started working on it, and it took quite a while. And while he's working on it, they needed an ultrasound probe and all this stuff. It seems like it's taking a while, and it feels like he's fumbling around with it. Obviously, he wasn't. But as he was doing that, below me on my left, this infinite black pit opened up, this just yawning black abyss. And I was like, damn, what is that? And I started getting pulled into it, and I started panicking because I had no idea I was dying. I mean, none, right? But I knew the animal instinct in me knew you don't want to go into the infinite black pit, right? That's just like better to avoid, right? And I started panicking. And as I was panicking, my dead father, and I'm going to reiterate right now for those of you, for anyone who joined, you know, at this point, I'm an atheist. My father was an atheist. He was a physicist. Like, not only am I not a mystic, I'm actively anti-mystic, right? I just want nothing to do with any of it, right? My dead father appeared above me to help me cross over. He was like, it's okay. You don't have to fight it. You can come with me. I'll take care of you, right? I didn't know I was dying. I was horrified. I was like, come with you? You're dead. I'm alive. I'm not going anywhere with you. What are you talking about? Dead? Not now. Like, get out of here. Right? And I said to the doctor, you got to hurry. I'm going. You're losing me right now. I'm going. And he succeeded in putting the needle in, and they transfused me. And now they're using a rapid transfuser to push blood into my system. And, you know, the doctor said I was probably 10 minutes from dead. You know, I mean, I was going into hemorrhagic shock. I was convulsing on the table. You know, I mean, I was at all the last awful signs of like, you're about to go. And it felt terrible. It was the worst feeling.
So just going back to the ambulance ride for a second, just as something else for us to consider in the world of EMS. Were there any vital signs when you kind of look back that suggested it, or were you just in such good compensatory shock that everything was looking good? Because I mean, we only have limited capacity on an ambulance anyway, so the treatment probably right. would have been exactly the same whether they knew or not.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, the only option they had would have been to drive faster, right? I mean, they don't have blood on an ambulance. They can restart your heart, obviously, but with some pads. But apparently, and again, I'm not a doctor. I learned all this by interviewing. I circled back around to write my book, and I interviewed all the people that saved my life. And so I talked to the guy in the back, Joe, in the back of the ambulance with me. Though he would be technically a paramedic. Is that the term? Is that the correct term?
Yeah, most likely. Yeah. Some have just EMTs, okay. But usually it's an EMT and or a paramedic.
Okay. All right. So Joe, what he said later was that the classic sign of internal hemorrhage is a high heart rate. Because you're bleeding, you have low blood volume, your heart has to pump harder to maintain sufficient arterial pressure to keep you conscious and to keep your heart beating. And so your blood pressure, your heart rate will go up, 80, 90, 100, 110, the kinds of heart rates you would typically see when someone goes out for a run. But I was a lifelong athlete. I was a marathon runner when I was young. I ran 4:12 for the mile in college. I kept a lot of that sort of good shape, athletic sort of like life. And so I think I have a fairly big, efficient heart. So my heart rate was just sort of hanging out in the 70s. It never went up. So Joe was like, okay, whatever's going on, he's not bleeding out into his own abdomen. He's got indigestion, right? He lost his bowels. He's like, something's gone. Maybe he ate some bad oysters, that's what he's ticking through for completely good reasons, right? And I was coherent, right? I hadn't gone off a cliff yet because I was in compensatory shock. So I was joking with him. I called my family and said, hey, I'm fine. Don't worry about me. My daughter said, I love you to the moon and back, which now just makes me cry when I think about it, because statistically should have been the last thing she ever said to her daddy, and by some miracle it wasn't. But poor Joe, I mean, I was an extremely misleading patient to Joe. But the belly pain was intense, and the history that I had of being in and out of consciousness, like whatever my blood pressure was in the ambulance and whatever my heart rate was doing, if there was a period where I was in and out of consciousness and losing my vision, that should be a tip off that the person's bleeding to death. They've staved it off for a while with compensatory shock, but you're heading right to the edge of a cliff.
I just interviewed a young girl who had a horrendous ATV crash at like 50 miles an hour into a parked car. She was messing around in a suburban area, and she survived. She had massive TBI and she survived, and she's now cheerleading again.
Was this in Wilmington, North Carolina?
Oh my goodness, I'm trying to remember where they live now.
It was Florida. Florida. All right. So one of my best friends saved a girl who rode an ATV into the side of a parked car in Wilmington, North Carolina. And he was a soldier and he knew some combat stuff. And so, yeah. Anyway, I just thought, wow, what a coincidence. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go on.
There was a combat medic on scene. I wonder if it was the same call. Yeah, that's really, I'm going to have to look into that now, but we'll figure that out later. Okay. Because either way, I mean, if two things happen, that's what the takeaway was, apart from her miraculous recovery. But the point being, obviously, the mechanism of injury, it was very apparent, it was evident what was going on there. But the takeaway was how dangerous ATVs are, and they're good under controlled situations in an area that's designed for an ATV. But, you drive them in the wrong place at the wrong speed with no helmet, you now are burying a child. So that was the lesson learned from that. But as a medic, we're taught, with abdominal pain specifically, that is that kind of gray area where we just don't know. We don't have ultrasound. We don't have CTs or MRIs. So we have to err on the side of caution. But, painting the picture of what it's like to actually be an EMT or a paramedic in America, and the frequency of calls and the sleep deprivation and the burnout, there is, the danger of going, I think you're fine, just sign here, And so this is what's important with this is every so often, a true emergency is going to be hidden amongst arguably a lot of bullshit calls, to be completely honest. And so that complacency can set in. So I think it's important for the first responders listening of some of these cautionary tales that had that not been taken seriously, you wouldn't be with us today.
Yeah. And, the thing is, their hands were tied. They don't have blood in the ambulances. So even if they'd known what was happening, I don't think there's anything he could have done else that he could have done. Like, one IV pack and that's it. Apparently, if you give too much IV fluid, you're risking acidosis in the blood and, other things that can kill you. Like, so it's, their hands were tied. I mean, you'd need to roll with with blood that you could you'd need to roll with the ability to transfuse people in the ambulance.
Yeah, which I think is the next step for my community, to be honest, because, you know, in trauma, yeah. What we can do is plug the hole and drive as fast as we can. So,
right.
All right. Yeah. So then you do a beautiful job, obviously, of leading people through, you know, what happens and the amazing, you know, courage by some of the people in medicine and, you know, what they were able to finally do to find this aneurysm, stop the bleeding, you know, and then ultimately, you know, get you back on your feet. So let's talk about the other side of that now. As you mentioned, staunch atheist, sea father by Black Void. what was the kind of emotional processing, and then lead me through that, you know, ending up becoming the book that we're going to discuss?
Yeah, so it took hours in the interventional radiology suite to fix the problem. So the IR suite, they basically use, it's basically an X-ray machine that gives live video to the doctor, and they can watch in real time as they manipulate things inside your body. And so they were threading a catheter from my groin inside my vascular system, trying to get it to the source of the bleed, which was in my pancreatic artery. And there's a lot of twists and turns, and you know, these catheters can turn, but they can't make really sharp turns. It's hard, you know, whatever, it's complicated. And they, after 6 hours, and I, you know, I'm not sedated because I arrived at the hospital, my blood pressure was 60 over 40, right? I mean, I was at nothing left, right? And so they couldn't just put me out. And I think they needed for me to be able to answer questions. And so, and I'm in screaming pain. I'm in so much pain because I've got all this blood sitting in my organs, against my organs. And they're it's called an insult to your kidneys and to your liver. And it's extremely painful. And I'm like begging them for painkillers. And of course, the doctors are totally ignoring me. Like, doctors, they don't even respond. I mean, you could say anything you want to a doctor and it's like you don't exist, right? It's really amazing. And then the nurses are much more empathic, and they're like, it's okay, sweetheart, we're gonna get you through this. it's very, very funny. But the doctors are like these two robots, thank God, right? But so they finally got the catheter to the bleed site and embolized it, plugged it with a coil, and pulled their gear out, and then sort of filled me up with other people's blood, topped me off with 10 units, and good to go, right? So I, you know, they wheeled me into the ICU, and then I think they sedated me because I don't have any memories after that. I sort of like goes black pretty quickly, and then I sort of wake up in the ICU the next morning, really confused, and the ICU nurse says, "Congratulations, Mr. Younger. We almost lost you last night. You almost died. In fact, no one can believe you're alive." And, you know, I looked it up later. The odds of my surviving were as low as 30%. And that was probably based on a reasonable transport time to a hospital. That, you know, that statistic probably doesn't reflect a 90-minute transport time, right? So what are my, you know, what were my odds? I in the single digits, right? Or something like that. Luckily, I'm a healthy, strong guy. And I gave the doctors something to work with. And at least that's what the doctor said later. But so I was shocked that I had no idea I'd almost died. I was, imagine waking up from a nap and having your wife say, "You almost died." You know, like, you're in the hospital, you almost died. It's shocking, really shocking, right? And then she left, and I'm just sit there. I'm throwing up blood. I'm a total mess. I'm so weak, I can't even sit up. I'm this tangle of wires going all over me. My back's in agony. I mean, I'm a hurting puppy, right? But I just keep thinking about it. I almost died? Are you freaking kidding? My girls almost lost their father. My wife almost lost her husband. Are you kidding? I couldn't believe it. It was really traumatic. And so then the nurse came back a while later and said, "How are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm okay." You know, I lied. I was doing terribly. But I said, "I'm okay. But, you know, frankly, it's terrifying what you told me. I mean, I'm really struggling with it." And she said, "Try this. Instead of thinking about it as something scary, try thinking about it as something sacred." Then she walked out of the room. And so I've been sort of working on that the entire time, right? I mean, my book is partly an attempt to answer that question. And I don't know what she meant specifically. It may be Maybe she meant you should go to church more often, Mr. Younger. I mean, I have no idea what she meant, but I'm going to make my own meaning out of it, which is basically, I went to the threshold of life and death, the place where we're all headed. I was allowed to peek over the edge into the abyss and then allowed to come back. Like most people aren't, most people you get, you know, once you glimpse that, you're headed in, right? I was allowed to come back. What did I learn? For me, as a secularist, what the word sacred means to me, and I think there are sacred jobs, sacred callings, the word sacred means anything that helps people lead their lives with more dignity. That's what sacred means. And that's so it's true from some medical professionals and some people in the ministry and maybe some psychologists and maybe some writers and et cetera, et cetera. It's like what helps you people live with more dignity and less pain, right? That's so I was like, I've been going to front lines my whole life. I now sort of went to my own front line and I was allowed to come back. What did I learn? What did I learn that might be of value to other people? And so my book, and I did, people keep asking, like, so are you still an atheist? I'm like, yes, I'm still an atheist. But I'm a changed atheist, right?
You're a born again atheist.
I'm a born again atheist. Right. I've been touched, right? I mean, I have been changed by this experience. And I'm not an agnostic, right? I do not believe in God. I do not believe that God is part of our daily lives. And I just don't believe, you know, it's like you can't choose to believe in God any more than you can choose to fall in love with Sally. Like you're either in love with Sally or you're not in love with Sally. But you can't choose to be. And I'm like, I just don't believe in him, right? Or her. Like I'm sorry. But that doesn't mean that you can't think about life in quote sacred terms, right? And so I don't think you need God to lead a moral life, to lead a meaningful life, to help others. And you know, ultimately, what I mean, this is the very, very short version of where I came to in the book, sort of philosophically, is that we by necessity we take life for granted because otherwise, focusing on the unspeakable miracle of life at every moment would prevent you from actually leading that life and doing the dishes and taking care of your kid and doing whatever. Like you actually have to block out what a freaking miracle the whole thing is in order to live the life that is a miracle, right? But what this incident did is basically I learned, you know, sometimes you got to stop thinking, stop doing, and just stand there for even a moment and just understand what a miracle existence is. Any existence. Any form of existence. I mean, if the universe existed and we're a bunch of rocks, it would be a miracle, right? A universe that only contained frogs would be a miracle, right? I mean, everything about it's a miracle. And the idea that this universe, 14 billion years old, 93 billion light years across, the odds of it existing are almost infinitely small. They're 10 to the negative 230. The fact that this universe produced conscious beings that can contemplate their own consciousness is something that defies explanation, defies belief, understanding, but it doesn't defy appreciation. And one of the things you must do in life is stop and understand what a miracle this is, that you even exist enough to think that it's a miracle. And you can do that in a traffic jam. You can do that when your kid has a fever. You can do that when faced with your own final diagnosis of terminal, whatever it's going to be that takes you out. You know, if I went through a brief period after this where they thought that I might also have pancreatic cancer. There was something called a neoplasm against my pancreas. The neoplasm, it just means new tissue that shouldn't be there. And it was old blood from what it turned out to be was old blood from the aneurysm, from the bleed. But they didn't know that. And the doctor was like, listen, just because you had a ruptured artery doesn't mean you can't also have pancreatic cancer. We ought to check this out. So for a while, they did a lot of testing to make sure that this thing wasn't cancerous. And had it been, it wasn't, thank God. But had I gotten the most devastating news that, no, you're going to die in a few months, you also have pancreatic cancer, life's even sacred then. Sorry. Like, it's still a miracle, right? And so, that awareness is sort of in my back pocket now, in a way that it never was before and couldn't have been. And I think that's ultimately what that nurse meant, or that's the meaning that I gave to what she said.
Speaking of that nurse, talk to me about you trying to find her.
Well, it was quite strange. I mean, one of the things I struggled with after this was trying to figure out what was real and what wasn't. And I entered a rather paranoid phase of worrying that I actually had died and that I was a ghost. I actually wasn't here, right? And the origins of that were that 36 hours prior, so two nights prior, the dawn of the previous day, I'd been woken up. Now, my family, we co-sleep. At the time, my daughters were 6 months and 3 years on a pad on the floor. And it was dawn, and I had a dream that I had died. Not that I was going to die, or not that I did die. And that for lack of a better word, and I'm sorry, I apologize for the Christian connotations of this word, but my soul was hovering above my grieving family. And I didn't know I was dead. I was like, hey, I'm over here. You don't need to cry. I'm right here. Don't. And then I was made to understand, no, you died. You're dead. You can't go back. They can't hear you. It's done forever. And I was so anguished. I was just bereft. And there's my family. I just want to hold them. I just want to go to them, right? And I can't. And I'm getting sort of pulled away. And I was so upset that it woke me up. And then, boom, I'm in my room. I'm in our bedroom. And there's my eldest daughter's right next to me. I sort of clutched her. And like they clutched their stuffies. I was like sort of clutching her like, oh, my God, thank God. Thank God that was a dream, right? And so then I got this very paranoid feeling after I came back from the hospital. I was in the ICU for 5 days. I set records for recovery from abdominal hemorrhage, and then on the regular floor for a couple of days. And I was home. It was done in a week. And I came home, and you'd think it would be a kind of party, like, whoa, I almost died. Let's celebrate. It's not. It's almost like a kind of funeral. Like, wow, we're all so lucky. Like, I can't believe. A really somber time. And I just kept crying all the time, right? I mean, I just like, I was incredibly emotional, and I started to think maybe the dream reproduced what are called NDEs, near-death experiences, very, very closely. So when people come back, there's a lot of documentation of this, when people almost die like I did, or do die if their heart stops and then they're revived, that one of the most common experiences is this sort of hovering above your family or hovering above the doctors and being sort of drawn away. And that's what had happened to me. And I knew nothing about NDEs at the time. And I started to get this paranoid idea that maybe that was my experience of actually dying, that I actually did die, right? And that everything that followed the trip to the hospital and the return home and et cetera is all a dying hallucination, right? It's all happening in my mind as I'm in my last hours and minutes and seconds, right? It's all a hallucination. And there's a terrifying and wonderful movie called Jacob's Ladder, where that happens to a soldier who's dying on the battlefield in Vietnam. And he's dreaming that he actually went home, and they're his death dreams. He's actually still on the battlefield. It's a terrifying movie. At any rate, I got very, very paranoid. I went to my wife at one point. I was like, "Can you just tell me? Just tell me I'm really here, right? Just can you confirm that I got a heartbeat and you're talking to me and this, I'm really alive, right? And she said, of course, sweetheart, you're right here, you're safe, blah, blah, blah. And then in my mind, I didn't say this, my mind are like, that's exactly what a hallucination would say, right? Right? I'm on to you. Like, I got very kind of crazy. So I started to research all this stuff because I'm a journalist and I'm a nerd and that's what I do. And, you know, one of the strands of research is, you know, frankly, we actually, there is no way to prove what is and isn't real. And consciousness is an enormous enigma that nobody really understands. And, you know, at the quantum level, it's all an infinite mystery. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm opening Pandora's box of deep, deep philosophical and physical questions, and, you know, in physics and quantum physics. But one thing I tried to do is find the nurse who gave me the best advice of my life, right? And I called the hospital. The ICUs are quite sequestered. You can't just walk into an ICU and say, hey, where's Brenda? You know, I mean, that doesn't work. But you, so I went through the PR department and the staffing department, et cetera, et cetera. And not only did they not know who I was talking about, because they could look up who was working that day, right? Not only did they not know who was I was talking about, there wasn't even a nurse who fit that description, like that was on duty in that week, right? I mean, they do total blank, just nothing. So I really started to wonder, not to be all woo-woo or anything, but I was like, am I sure that happened? I mean, am I sure that wasn't a vision? Like, my father was a bit, you know, like, and what is real? And I mean, I really just started to question absolutely everything. And I wound up getting incredibly anxious and depressed. I mean, the sort of like short version is that kind of questioning is paralyzing. And if you really are questioning whether you died or not, I basically was turning myself into, I was giving myself schizophrenia or something. I mean, I was no longer in reality, right? Like I was one foot in another world. And my wife finally said, listen, you're actually getting a little hard to live with. Can you please get some help? You know, I finally did. And I was getting extremely depressed and anxious as well. And so I actually finally talked to someone. And it turns out it was like what I was going through psychologically was fairly common for people who have almost died from medical causes.
You talk about Tyler Carroll in the book, and he's become a friend as well. Dead Reckoning Collective is an amazing group of people. How did you come about across Tyler, and talk to me about his example that you used?
Yeah, I mean, amazing young man. He was at a veterans retreat that I was invited to as an author, and they sort of read all my, it's called Patrol Base Abate in Western Montana. It was last June, and they read all my books, and I was there to talk to them for a wonderful long weekend in the mountains of Montana. It was amazing. And he was one of the vets who was there, and he just sort of mentioned, I mean, I sort of mentioned what happened to me, and he was like, oh, basically the same thing happened to me in the battlefields of Afghanistan. And he bled out from a shrapnel wound, and he had something that people who study near-death experiences, and I know all this because I did all this research about the phenomenon, what they call a life review. So as he's in and out of consciousness, he's entering this place where he sees his entire life is quite a common thing, his entire life simultaneously. And he has a kind of universal love and understanding and clarity about all things and his entire life. And he survived. And so I interviewed him about that experience, and I use him as an example. You know, I mean, as a journalist, I'm loath to just write about myself. It seems self-indulgent and, you know, whatever. So, you know, part of my professional sort of DNA, as it were, is to interview other people, because the self is not really a worthy topic and just on its own. So I interviewed some amazing people, and one of them was Tyler about his experience.
I had his mother on. She was I think it was an Apache pilot, swears like a sailor. Such an amazing conversation. But yeah, she was an absolute spark plug.
right. Yeah, amazing. Yeah, yep.
So one thing that really jumped out at me, and it was literally a sentence in the book, but I think it resonates so deeply because when we look, and I'm sure you and I have talked about this before, I mean, you literally underlined that your fitness saved your life. And that's the same with Matt Chan and some other people I had on the show, that their diligence with their physical health is what created their survival. And obviously, sadly, we saw the opposite of that during COVID. But as we see people getting, you know, more and more overweight and obese and sicker, we also have in this country, obviously, a heavy faith-based community. And it saddens me, and this just me, and everyone else might be absolutely fine the way they are, but it saddens me that there's almost this, like, don't worry about here, because you're going to go to a place that's so much better. There's going to be angels and waterfalls and unicorns or whatever you believe in. And I find it so sad because of the miracle that I know. The only thing that I know, whether it's perception, whatever it is right now. I know that if I'm an asshole in the world, I make it worse. If I'm kind in the world, I make it better. You know, if I pour myself into my child, the chance of him becoming a kind, compassionate adult is far greater. So this is my reality. The nature around me, the trees, the sunshine, the ocean, the sand. And so when you were talking about the Arab nations in the Middle Ages, and you talked about that was, you know, kind of the renaissance of science back then, algebra, alchemy. And then you said there was a shift where kind of religion pulled people away from that. I think there's, you know, obviously in this conversation, there is space for both to exist simultaneously, and people lean into whichever one they adhere to more. But when something is disregarded or held as heresy by religion, that becomes extremely dangerous. And we've obviously seen that in certain places around the world. What is your perception of, you know, let's take that time, you know, when science is turned into heresy, what is that? What are the dangers of a society when that happens?
Well, the incredible quality of life and abundance that we enjoy right now in Western society since, you know, the 1600s, is the result of Enlightenment era empirical thinking, right? So if you think sunflower seeds can cure cancer, you give a whole bunch of people with cancer sunflower seeds, and then a whole bunch of people who have cancer, you don't give them sunflower seeds, you give them pecans, and see if there's a difference in survival rate, right? That's empiricism. And that's how we develop medicines and surgery and airplanes that fly and everything, and the toaster, right? I mean, everything, right? And so what my father used to say is that in the Middle Ages, in the Dark Ages, the Muslim world were the leaders in science and in medicine and in astronomy and in math. And their scientific inquiry was just divorced from the religious thought that ran parallel within Muslim society, right? They were separated. The largest library in the world was in Alexandria. At the time. And then it shifted. And the Enlightenment came to Europe. It came to the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages of Europe. And Copernicus and Galileo and Sir Isaac Newton and on. I mean, the sort of long roster of brilliant, brilliant thinkers. You're right, all the way up to Stephen Hawking in our era. That was Enlightenment era thinking, which basically said, you know what, God, if you just use God to explain everything, you understand nothing. And there are ways of understanding and predicting the natural world. We can tell you when the next eclipse will be because we know the movements of the stars and the sun and the planets. These are mathematically predictable. The sun is at the center of our solar system, not the earth, right? And of course, Galileo was threatened with being burned at the stake for uttering such a heresy, but it's the truth. And, you know, he declined the honor of being burned at the stake for secular thought and gave the Catholic Church what it wanted. But everyone knew damn well it was nonsense. And so the incredible blessings, material blessings and technological and scientific blessings of our society are the result of secular Enlightenment era thinking. And we completely reversed roles with the Muslim world, which lapsed into sort of religious authoritarianism, and it's there still, right? And, you know, in the Arab Spring and in all of the sort of wars that have roiled those regions, the weapons that everyone's using were developed by the West, right? They were developed by Western engineers and scientists, right? It's not like the Mujahideen in Afghanistan were using weapons developed in Muslim society in Afghanistan. They were using weapons developed in freaking Russia by Russian engineers, right? So that's the advantage of Enlightenment era thinking, which doesn't mean there's no role for responsible religion. I put those two words together very intentionally, for responsible religion. And of course, it doesn't preclude a role. But the idea that God is the answer to all things deprives us of the miracle of God's world, right? I mean, God, if you want to follow the thinking, and I don't ascribe things to God, but if you want to follow it, like, all right, God gave you life, God gave you this world, and you're now telling me to don't worry about it because then there's something after? This ultimate gift from God? Like, yeah, don't worry about it. That's just, yeah, you know, that's, you'll be done with this soon enough. Like, that to me is heresy, right? Like, come on. And that's why Karl Marx loathed religion, because, you know, this is the time of enormous oppression of the serfs, who had virtually slaves in Russian society, right? I mean, they were sort of the peasant class that had no rights whatsoever. And Karl Marx wanted to bring a sort of economic and social political revolution to Russia. And what he hated about religion is that the Orthodox priests who were in league with the authoritarian rulers, with the Tsar, because one of the unfortunate things about the church is it often allies itself with the wealthiest, most powerful and abusive people in the country. Shame on you all, right? Because of that, the Orthodox priests were sort of telling the peasant class, like, don't worry about it. Yeah, your lives suck because you're serfs in Tsarist Russia. But in the afterlife, you know, the humble shall inherit, the meek shall inherit the earth. And in the afterlife, you're going to be fine, right? And that's why Karl Marx hated it, because it demotivated the working class, the peasant class, from throwing off the chains of rebellion and bringing dignity to themselves and their lives.
You use the word responsible religion. I think the same can also be applied to medicine. And as we just heard, the incredible medical practitioners, from paramedics to nurses to doctors, that, you know, were the chain of survival for you, that was modern medicine at its absolute, you know, pinnacle. However, when you look at chronic disease management, that is not responsible medicine. Telling people all you need is a pill for your mental health problems, or you need is a pill for your high blood pressure or your cholesterol, is extremely irresponsible. And so I think this is another thing, is whether it's religion, whether it's science, when the wrong people are at the helm, they abuse it. At their core, they're both beautiful philosophies. Whether you choose to subscribe to religion or not, that's entirely everyone's individual journey. But when it becomes a tool for power and greed, whether it's medicine or religion, that's an entirely different conversation.
Absolutely. I mean, I would just say that anything that disproportionately empowers a small number of people and gives them sort of rights that no one else has, that's evil. And that's true of fascism. It can be true of religion. It can be true of medicine and technology and everything else. You know, I believe it's Google, that their assets are something north of $1 trillion. Sorry. Like, I'm not good with that. And I don't, I mean, not to boast or anything, but this is my phone, right? I mean, I have a flip phone. Like, I'm not going to actually, like, lay myself open to your algorithms that are designed to addict me to a process that gives you $1 trillion and allows you to influence the outcomes of elections and all kinds of other nasty stuff and addict our children, right? Like, sorry, thank you, no, I'm not going to be part of that. And I think it's just absolutely disgusting that capitalism, which has brought an enormous good to this society, right, has also brought that. Like, then I think it's I hope there's a time of reckoning coming for that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Well, I want to hit one more area, and speaking of children, let you get back to yours. But you touched on DMT and ketamine when you were talking about the kind of neuroscience side. One thing that I've seen, I'm sure you have as well, being so well embedded in the military community, is the incredible healing that is happening with some of these psychedelic therapies when it comes to trauma in uniform, in this particular example. Talk to me about just your observation of that entire philosophy and conversation.
Yeah, so I haven't actually researched that per se. I've heard about it anecdotally. Myself, I'm the trauma that I dealt with, I've dealt with successfully through talk therapy and just the passage of time. And if I were in a more extreme situation, I might turn to that kind of remedy, but I'm not. So that aside, I'm completely sober. I don't do drugs. I don't drink at all. Once in a while, I smoke a cigarette, but really very occasionally. That's the limit of my sin. And, you know, one of the reasons I don't want a smartphone is because I enjoy being sober, and that includes digitally sober. So, just to explain sort of where I'm coming from. But I have heard that those kinds of drug therapies, DMT, ketamine, can be incredibly therapeutic. And I cheer that, right? I mean, I don't know, but if it's helping anybody, that's great. They seem to reproduce something. The hallucinations they produce seem to have some things in common with the visions, hallucinations, experiences, whatever you want to call them, of people that are on the threshold of death. And there seem to be some common elements, you know, as there are with some of the ideas around shamanism. And every society in the world has some kind of idea that there's the world of the living, and then there's this other world where the dead reside, and that the interface between them is mysterious and fluid and not entirely understood. And certain people can go to that threshold and come back with knowledge of the other world, of the afterworld. Those would be shamans. Those might be people who almost died and came back and saw their dead ancestors, like I saw my dead father. Certainly, the drug ayahuasca is used by shamans in the Amazon basin, who travel to the world of the dead and come back. There are all these commonalities around that threshold. And it does make me wonder, I mean, as an atheist, like it does make me wonder, I mean, the a lot of the near-death phenomena that are known can be explained through sort of neurochemistry, right? I mean, your low blood oxygen and the release of neurochemicals that stimulate hallucinations. And you can explain a lot of it through neuroscience. But the one thing that actually sort of fails that way of thinking, that rationalist way of thinking, is why do the dying see the dead? And only the dying see the dead, right? And hospice nurses will tell you that. People in the backs of paramedics in the backs of ambulances. The literature, the NDE literature, is filled with it. I mean, if you give a room full of people LSD, you know 100% they will all have hallucinations. Like science will tell you that. And we know the neurochemical mechanism for producing that. No mystery there, right? But they will not all have the same hallucination. And what's strange about the shamans and the dying and sometimes people on DMT is that they see the dead. And that to me, actually, if there's a great mystery here, it's that. And how do we explain it? And so my book is divided into two sections. What and if. What explains what happened to me? If is basically, what if there were something else? What if this physical reality that we experience as life isn't the only reality, and there's something, you know, commonly called the afterlife, which is a term that I kind of loathe, but what if there was something? How would it work? Like, what's the thought experiment for how that would conceivably work? And that's where my book lands towards the end in quantum physics, which is really the sort of deep mystery of science, is how things work at the quantum level. And as I say in the book, if there is some post-death reality that we just don't understand, the explanation would be somewhere, in my opinion, would probably lie somewhere in the quantum realm, and we might not even be capable of understanding it. Likewise, we're not capable of understanding why the universe exists at all. We just can't, we cannot wrap our minds around it. I think we'll probably never know. Well, likewise, it might be tied into one of the secrets about a post-death existence. They don't, you know, gravity, for example, is a force that pervades the universe. And it's the reason the universe exists and exists the way it does. It's possible that consciousness is also another fundamental element of the physical universe and creates the universe as it is known to be. And that is not lost when you biologically die. It's possible. Just good luck trying to prove it.
As I was reading the science part at the end, all that knot in my stomach came back when I was 19 and my friend was talking about it. I was like, oh, no. Yeah. But then a red cardinal flew into the garden. I'm sitting on my back porch and I was kind of pulled back to, you know, what I know, what matters to me at this moment, the gratitude element again. Just one more area, just super quick. One thing I've heard that I think is beautiful is with some of these psychedelics, they found that people who are terminally ill, who are literally knowingly counting down some of the days of that, you know, their particular diagnosis, are finding a lot of peace doing some of these journeys and feeling that belonging of something bigger than just this. Did you stumble across any of that kind of conversation when you were researching?
I did. I didn't include it in the book, but that's, you know, that's part of the conversation right now. But, you know, I interviewed a number of hospice nurses, and, you know, my mother was talking to her dead brother in her last hours. My father was talking to his dead sister. Hospice nurses will tell you that a very common thing is to have people engaging with the dead in the room, right? No one else can see them, but they're right there, and the dying person is engaging with them, talking with them, interacting with them. And that's very, very common. And it was one very moving story. This hospice nurse said that she was taking care of somebody, a man who was, you know, elderly and in his last hours. And he, unlike most dying people, he was not in pain and not on morphine. He was completely clear-minded. And his wife had gone into the kitchen to make some lunch. And the nurse was with this gentleman. And he started talking. He said, oh, thank God there's Barbara, and started talking to Barbara, whoever Barbara was, right? And seemed enormously heartened to see her. And so the nurse went into the kitchen and said to the wife, I think he's close. Now he's talking to someone named Barbara. Do you know who that is? And the wife mortified the nurse for a moment by saying, yes, Barbara was the love of his life. And of course, the nurse was like, oh no, oh my God. And then the wife said, that was our 19-year-old daughter. And if you're a father, I mean, you can't, I can hardly say that without choking up, right? I mean, and so that, and he went out, you know, Barbara came, just like my father came, Barbara came to help him over, to help him across, right? And my enduring question is like, how does that work? Because no one else sees the freaking dead, right? Like, how does that work? And the rationalists and the neurochemists and all this, they have lots of great theories about why dying people might hallucinate. They are utterly mute on the idea of why they all hallucinate essentially the same thing, which is that the dead show up. And even sometimes people that they didn't know were dead because the other person had just died. Like, that's also an extremely strange phenomenon. And it's been documented many, many times.
Well, I think that's the perfect place to end. I want to say thank you again for your generosity coming on the show again. And not only that, but with a sick child and having shingles. So I'm so honored that you suffered through that and did the interview. But I truly appreciate it. And again, I've, you know, shouted from the rooftops about your book. You know, Tribe is held with such high regard from, you know, so many communities that have shared suffering. Freedom was phenomenal as well. And then now we have the new one. So I want to thank you so much for writing the book and kind of getting this conversation even out there and for coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure. I always enjoy talking to you.